Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is episode 164 of the Distraction Pieces podcast. My name is Scroobius Pip. Thanks for tuning in, guys. Another exciting one of this week, last week's episode. This week's episode is really interesting because it's with comedian Sophie Hagen, who's fantastic. And I should mention now, I mentioned it in the podcast, but we did each other's podcasts in a row. So first I was a guest on Sophie's and then we recorded this where Sophie is a guest on mine. So if you enjoy this, then you can go and enjoy more of this nonsense. But with the tables turned and flipped on Sophie's podcast, Made of Human. This is a really interesting one because there was a few things that came up in last week's podcast with the wonderful Laurie Penny that can't come up again here with Sophie, but Sophie has a different outlook on them. And I love this shit, man. I think all issues of, just many social issues, particularly in women's rights and in men's rights at the moment, and trans rights, it's ever evolving. And I think the more these things are debated and you're open to being corrected on stuff, the more fascinating it is. So yeah, I really enjoyed these two as kind of a pair, last week's and this week's. Anyway, I should also mention before we get to the podcast that I'm doing a live podcast. It's the only live Distraction Pieces podcast I'll be doing this whole year. Previously, I've done three in London, I think, which have all sold out. I've done Manchester, which sold out. Glasgow and Edinburgh were two of the biggest I've done, and they were rammed. So, long story short, I've done a whole load, but I never got to do one in Ireland. So, whilst my plan this year was to be off from podcasts in general, from live podcasts, when the offer came in to do one at the Dublin Podcast Festival, I couldn't resist. So I'll be heading out there on the 21st of September. Grab your tickets. For those who don't know or haven't listened to previous live ones, I don't have guests on the live podcast because something, this podcast, as ramshackle as it sounds, there's conscious effort and theory that goes into it. The reason I don't have a producer or anything is, and these heavy tabletop mic stands I carry around with me, all this kind of thing, it's because I want them to be relaxed and feel like a conversation rather than an interview or a performance. And there's a lot of other little tricks and twists and trends I put in to try and make them so. And I hope it works. I think it works. It seems to be, with 3 years deep now, we're about to break 10 million downloads. So I think it works. But I don't think that would translate on stage. I think it would be a completely different thing. It would become a performance. And I don't want, this sounds harsh, I don't want to waste any guests on that. I'd rather have my guests in an intimate and private situation. So anyway, long story short, the way I did the first live one was, and everyone since, because they've worked really well, is to make you guys the guest, but not in a pass the microphone around the audience. I get a cue formed at the side of the stage, and you come up and you sit down with me, and you can ask a question. It can be a simple, quick question, or you can pick a topic or something you'd like to discuss and debate, and we have a proper chat. And that's how the live ones work. So if you're coming along to Dublin, if you've got your ticket already, then get preparing them questions because it's going to be a good one. So yeah, head in there. Go Tivoli Theatre, I think, in Dublin. I should mention we're brought to you by Speech Development Records.com. If you heard the secret birthday special, which I didn't post about online anywhere, it was a little secret. If you heard that, then you will have found that the gift to you guys was free music. So there is now a free music section giving away a load of the back catalogue at speechdevelopmentrecords.com. But we've also got loads of good stuff for you to buy. We've still got swimwear. The sunglasses have sold out. But we've got swimwear and leggings and vests were all part of our Dark Summer range, and hats. The the Dark Winter range is now in production. I've gone through all the designs, I've tweaked them, I've changed them, I've chosen the unusual items that we will be releasing. I may just lose a ton of money on this, but fuck it, it's worth it for unusual merch. So there's that. Speechvenom of iRuckles.com. What I also need to mention ahead of the release on August 31st is my trainer collaboration with OHW Shoes. Who Shoes? So it's Who backwards. If you don't know, we did a release last year. I teamed up with them and designed a shoe, and it was going to be a limited run, but it went better than we could have ever hoped because it sold out before release. We did a pre-order and they sold out in pre-order. So we decided this time round, number one, the last time round we didn't do any girls' sizes. So this time round we're doing a shoe and a boot, a trainer and a boot in a girl's design and in a guy's design. And I mean, it's prevalent, as we've had feminist writer Laurie Penny on last week and Sophie Hagen this week. We talk a lot about feminism, some kind of just social constructs and restrictions. But when doing the women's design, essentially, I wanted the women's design to mimic the previous man's design almost exactly. I've changed the fabric, but I've changed the fabric on the guys' ones too. But I wanted them to be dark and not go, oh, it's the women's version, here's some white ones or some pink ones or add some gold or anything like this. So we've done that with the girls' design, because when we released the last one, the men's design, there were loads of women who said, I want those trainers. They didn't say, I'd like a version that's a bit more feminine. So we just, yeah. Anyway, they come out on August 31st. I'm very excited about it. I'm not sure when the pre-order will be going up, but on my social media, at Scribius Pipio, I'm teasing images in the build-up. I'm trying so hard to hold off, but I've got some really cool images of these things. So, yeah, I'm trying to resist on that for the moment. Anything else I need to tell you? Oh, the Fringe is on still. Go and see Sage Francis and B. Dolan, Tricknology at the Fringe. I recommend that. As I record this, I'm recording this earlier. So as you're listening, I'm recording this early last week because I'm heading up to the Fringe at the end of the week to catch Sage and Dolan and Rob Alton's hair show, which is, it looks amazing. So yeah, I recommend you check them out. While I'm up there, I'm going to try and catch Sophie Hagen's show, who is today's guest. So without further ado, get stuck in to episode 164 of the Distraction Pieces podcast with Sophie Hagen. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces.
Do you want me to also do a backup on this one, just in case?
I'll do
it. Yeah, I mean, sure. I'll do it. That's good. It's good to have the cover. I like it. It looks like it's working.
It looks like it's working.
I once did, I had this same recorder, and I programmed the spoken word at Best of All and Camp Best of All, and I was like, for my radio show, I was like, I'm going to interview tons of the spoken word artists backstage. And I had previously been using it a few nights before in the way that you're using it now, with two mics plugged into the bottom.
Oh yeah.
In the field I didn't have them, but I'd left it on that setting.
Yeah.
So I recorded hours of interviews, got home, there wasn't a thing on there. Because I didn't have mics plugged in. I was thinking it's using the mics at the top of the recorder.
Yeah.
I didn't have a thing. Okay. So I got home and I was like, how am I going to explain this to all the poets that I chatted to for ages backstage? And
I feel like it's like every kind of broadcastery type person's worst nightmare.
Yeah, it's absolutely. I mean, the one thing that made it slightly better was I was recording it for my XFM show, and the guy I produced that show with, Dan Rido, a week or so before, he had done the same, except it was with someone like Mumford and Sons. It was some huge band, and he just hadn't recorded it. And it was like, well, he's not going to... He can't judge me if I'm not recording a few of my spoken word mates. I should introduce... I'm joined downstairs at the Phoenix Art Club by Sophie Hagen. How are you?
I'm good. I'm good. I'm going to step down. I feel a bit...
It's interesting. Yeah. I did this with Adam Buxton. I've just been a guest on your podcast for an hour, and now you're becoming a guest on my podcast for an hour. And it's weird because both of our styles, because the thought now is, right, I'm in control, so I have to step up and take the lead. But kind of both of our podcasts involve us as hosts sitting back slightly.
Yeah.
So it's that weird one of, I have to now take the lead, but you probably have to talk more now, because I was just talking loads because I was the guest. And yeah, it's a weird mix and crossover.
Yeah, I'm trying to let go. I'm very bad with control in general, so now I just have to go, no, you're not in charge anymore.
It's fine. You can relax and enjoy yourself. I mean, let's start with talking about podcasting. I mean, you've been doing it longer than me, I think. I think you started in 2013. Were you doing your first?
Oh, it must.
Your first ones?
Yeah, I'm trying to, because I remember... I lived in a house in Stratham Common. That won't help anyone with the year, apart from me.
Yeah.
Yes, it must have been.
So everyone's going to be like, oh, 2013. Oh, yeah. I remember when you lived there.
Because do you not do that when you think back of things? You go, I was on the bus around Leicester Square. Yeah,
yeah, that's the date. I know when that was.
Yeah, it must have been 13, if not 12.
And what kind of drew you to podcasting? Because particularly at that point, it was a very new medium.
I remember the first time I heard a podcast, because I didn't know how to listen to it. It was a Danish podcast, probably one of the first podcasts in Denmark, and it was a comedy podcast. And I remember the first episode came out, and me and my friend got together. We sat by the dining room table, we put it on the laptop, and we just sat and listened.
Amazing.
We were like, this is an odd way of of consuming content. But I remember being in a car on my way home from a gig. I don't remember why. I think I just had the idea for my first podcast, which was called Comedians Telling Stuff.
Yeah.
And that was a website I bought before anyone told me about the grammatical error in that title. It's my second language, by the way.
Yes, of course.
And I think what attracted me to that is the same thing that attracted me to comedy and basically everything else I've ever done in my life, which is I can do all of it myself.
Yeah.
I have full control of it. I can decide. It can be a minute long. It can be 3 hours long, and no one can stop me.
it's the beauty of it. It's what excites me so much about all media going forward. Mm. There's the potential for it, where even TV is going over to Netflix and Amazon and stuff like that. There's things like The OC, which came out. Was it The OC? No, The OA, which was on Netflix. And I was watching that series, and the first three or four episodes were all like an hour, hour and five, hour and 10, 50 minutes. And then there was an episode that was just 20 minutes long.
Oh,
and that excited me hugely. And it's not like as a series, it was my favourite series of the year, but that made me go, wow, you can just do that. You can just make it what it has to, like if you're living in the digital realm rather than on TV with specific slots and... Yeah. Things like that. It's like,
there's an amazing. You can do what you want. Have you heard of the Norwegian teenage TV show called Skam?
No.
Which means shame. Right. It is incredible. Yeah. And I you can get it with English subtitles.
Yeah.
I mean, illegally, but still.
Yeah.
On the internet. It is incredible. It's four seasons in. I think it's over now, but four seasons. Every episode is somewhere between, I think, 10 and 40 minutes.
Amazing.
Just random numbers. And it was. I think it was made by, some Norwegian TV channel. And it's about teenagers and teenage, and it shouldn't be interesting to adults, but it is.
Yeah.
And it's sweet, like Denmark and Sweden, everyone's obsessed with this teenage, and it's so exciting. And it's just about, it's so good.
Do you think the non-English speaking countries have a potential greater freedom when creating art, because you're not push into that Hollywood market, that American market, and so on and so forth? You've got it's excited me in the last even just 5 years that so much Scandinavian drama and French drama and stuff like that is coming into the UK because people are realising that there's really good stuff. But it feels that bit ahead and risks are taken a bit more because you're not sitting there going, oh, are the British going to like this or are the Americans going to like this? Whereas I think in Britain we do think, is America going to like this? Is this, do you know what I mean?
It's, yeah, maybe. I've never thought, I think I've arrogantly as an arrogant Danish person, I think I've always just assumed, oh, maybe we're just better.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe we can just do. But I think the, well, I don't know where money comes from really in Denmark, but like when it comes to creating films and stuff. But I do think that, yeah, because they're never going to make the money back, I guess. So yeah, there must be a lot of funding somewhere because something needs to be created, but we're not enough people to really earn them that money back.
Yeah, it's a fascinating one. It's kind of it puts a lot of the creation down to similar to what the BBC maybe is or is meant to be. That is, it's not purely about ratings. It's about the quality of a project and a product. And you will see with The Bridge and The Killing and things like this, it will say at the end, funded by.
Yeah, because that's all Denmark's Radio, which is our BBC.
Yeah.
So that's created by that. But I think we also, what we have that makes art better is there's not that need to be so formal.
Right,
you know, you can barely put on any Danish film without seeing genitals everywhere.
Yeah.
Not even in a sexual context or in a sexy context. Yeah. Just, oh, there's a guy pissing on the beach and you see everything.
Yeah.
You know, it's like horror films. There'll be a naked guy in a bed, just flaccid penis everywhere.
Yeah.
And no one cares. And that's prime time.
Such a dream. Oh, I mean, it sounds odd for me to be dreaming of a flaccid penis flaccid everywhere, but I literally am. But one of my first tour managers was Swedish, and he was stunned at the taboos of everything in the UK. He was like, as a teen, we would all go to the pub and we'd get home and then we'd all get in the sauna naked.
Yeah.
It's like, I know this sounds like a cliche, I know this, but it's like, that's just how it is, and it's that naturalness. And that openness has got to be a positive thing for art and creativity,
I
right?
I can't imagine it's not. Like, it is. Like watching, I didn't know I was proud of Danish, you know, culture, Danish art until I moved here because I just thought that was just, I never compared it to where it was from. But I was always extremely fascinated by Danish cinema. I thought I was going to be a director. I thought I was going to be a script writer. I thought I was going to be an actor because I was always obsessed with Danish cinema. I would never watch cartoons when I was a child. I always watched films. And they're dark, and it's one of my favorite examples is, and I think it's a Susanne Bier film called After the Wedding or Before the Wedding. I think it won like a massive, maybe an Oscar or something else. Anyways, there's a scene where a man and a woman, who, I think they're in a couple, they're arguing. And they're both screaming, they're both crying.
Mm.
And it looks so real. It is every single argument you've ever had.
And
there's nothing Hollywood about it. Yeah. The man is weeping.
Yeah.
Just full on. And he's, you know, and it's not a comedy. It's an actual serious dramatic scene where he is crying because of his feelings. You know, and it's so realistic and wonderful to just see a man cry because when men cry when men fight in Danish cinema it's not that punch it's actual like you know when men cry and they get like tears in their eyes and they're all like and it's that tension and no one really wants and they're pulling each other's hair and it's all awkward and real.
I love that.
I love it so much.
I really enjoyed, this is completely a step aside in the artistic side, but I really enjoyed the Netflix Daredevil series. I'll explain why I've gone to that, but there was a fight scene in that where he's fighting a load of different people and he gets tired and it's exhausting and they're falling over and it's not this slick, amazing fight scene. And the fight director of that was saying it was influenced a lot by Asians cinema and by European cinema and stuff like that, where it is that it's more realistic. It's not let's look out, let's make this just this amazing thing. It's like no, he's knackered and he's just about are getting through. I think the lack of censorship in society in Scandinavia, as you've said, equally has allowed the artistic boundaries to be pushed. An example that comes to mind for me that meant a lot, and I had a lot of debates about this online at the time, because I think I did a post I had a t-shirt that got misunderstood, but anyway, The Bridge, having the lead a lead character who's autistic, essentially, in Saga, who's not some autistic weirdo. She's the coolest, or one of the coolest characters in TV. Like, I just was in love with her from the second I met her.
When she talks to that little kid, has he lost a parent, or his dad got shot, and she gives him this book about how to deal with grief.
Yeah.
Like a 4-year-old child.
And it's again, just all of it, her demeanor and manner and everything. It's not, none of it feels like it's done in a we're going to represent autistic people way. It's done in that just happens to be who this character is, and her eccentricities and unusual her relationships, her interactions are going to be unusual. But that's, at no point do they make a big deal of it, or at no point is it seen as this is a real stand for. But it's beautiful, because of that. Is. And again, I think it's part that wouldn't, if they'd tried to do that in the UK, there would have been too many hoops to jump through, boxes to tick, people to be careful of, and it just wouldn't have happened.
Yeah, and their relationship is so beautiful.
Yeah, yeah.
Because he's not being super understanding and careful. He's he's super annoyed with her.
Yeah.
And fascinated and you know, tries to get it, but he's also just like, oh, come on.
Yeah. So growing up in Denmark, it was film and that kind of thing that was inspiring you ahead of comedy initially, right?
I mean, there was a lot of stuff. When I was a child, I wanted to be in Jurassic Park. I didn't want to be a...
I mean, that's a great ambition. Right? I completely...
Yeah, but my mom was always very good at keeping me level-headed, so she took me to an actual digging thing. Yeah,
excavation
thing. Yeah, that's a word. Good luck to me saying that way ever again. A digging thing. I'm going to keep with the digging
thing. Just go with digging thing, yeah.
Digging thing. So she took me to this little... we lived in this little village at that point called Sønderså. So she took me to this digging thing. And to see how they actually do it.
Yeah.
It's the most boring.
Yeah.
It's mud and tractors and, oh, God. So I was like, oh, so we don't just find...
The simple fictional addition of actual dinosaurs just makes it so much more exciting, doesn't it? Oh, my God.
Like, where's the sun? Yeah. Where's the little brush that I can brush off a little dinosaur bone?
Yeah.
And then I wanted to be a carer. And then my mom said, you have to wipe old people in the butt. And I was like, ew.
That's not fun.
At this point, I was 18. No.
Yeah.
And, but then when I became more teenager-y, it was all about film and writing. I started writing a lot. So I wanted to be director was my first thing. And then I became an intern at Centropa, which is one of the biggest film companies.
Oh, wow.
Which is run partly by Lars von Trier.
Right, yeah.
Who did the Dogma films which was incredible. It was the best, was it a month or 2 weeks? It was 2 weeks, but then... I was allowed to stay there over the holidays as well.
Wow, that's an amazing experience.
I just had so many tiny things that make me think that this is it. This is absolutely it. They let me watch like a screening of a new film that no one else had watched before. And amazing. I felt so lucky. And what was I, 13, 12, 13, 14? 14 maybe. And I watched this and I knew it was a screening, so I knew it wasn't done yet.
Yeah.
Like, they still had to do a lot of edits. And then everyone afterwards just stood in the circle, and the director was there. And I was sitting next to the director, and I could see he was, like, kind of not shaking, but he was, like, really nervous, just, like, touching his hands a lot, like, looking around the room, seeing people's reactions. And I was like, oh, my God, this is an artist. This is a true artist. And then afterwards, he was asking everyone about a specific, like, what people would change. And then I think to humor me or to be nice to me, he asked me, he said, which scene do you think could be cut? And I was like, my heart was in my throat. And I was like, And I was like, I think, I'm so sorry, but I think that scene with the kid and the dad, I just don't think that. And then the second I said that, he looked at another guy and he went, see, It's exactly what I said. And I was like, oh my God, I'm Steven Spielberg.
I mean, this is, there's an absolute beauty there of realization over the years of going, I want to be in Jurassic Park, because Jurassic Park is just, I love Jurassic Park. It's one of my favourite films. I've got a huge relationship with it.
Oh, it's brilliant.
To then seeing what archaeology is and excavations are and going, oh, this isn't that exciting. And then bridging that gap and saying, right, I want to be the person that makes this thing that's not very exciting into that thing that I fell in love with. So going, right, here's I found the real subject and it doesn't excite me, but look at what Spielberg and that turned that into. I want to make that magic.
Oh, that's an excellent point.
You know, it's yeah. That's kind of a beautiful path there of going, yeah. that this is such a letdown, but I'm not going to get here and go, oh, it's rubbish. Kind of be more motivated to go, how did someone trick me into thinking I wanted to do this? You know, it's kind of,
how can I be in a position where I can make people build me a big sand pile where I can still use the little brush and pretend? Yeah.
I'm not going to talk about Jurassic Park the whole time, but did you enjoy a Jurassic World?
Oh, which one was that? Is that the newest most
recent
one?
Yeah, the most recent. Is that, not the one that's out, because there's one that comes out next year.
Is it the one with Chris Pratt?
Yes.
Yeah, I like that.
I really enjoyed it. I had that, just, I mean, the childishness of the excitement of when the kind of edited version of the Jurassic Park theme comes in. Just small things that I didn't realise. It made me realise how attached I am to the original film and all the different bits that are little nods to it. I was just like, I remember just being in the cinema thinking, this might be good, it might not. And all those little easy little tricks of, we're just going to put this little bit of music there, just maybe, just have that little shiver of excitement.
There was one specific tiny, tiny detail where it just like punched the air. It was, they're all being attacked by dinosaurs, spoiler alert. And then there's one of the tourists, one of the just regular like extras, who is running away from like a dangerous, dangerous dinosaur. And he grabs his full drink and starts running with the drink. And I was like, that's what this whole series is. It's about how people, it's about capitalism being evil. This is about capitalism being, I know it's quite a leap, but I was like, no, this is people. He leave your fucking drink.
Yeah,
you know, you're about to die, I mean, but it's still great. Wanting greed and...
Yeah. I saw someone give kind of a breakdown of it and saying, oh, I couldn't watch it because there was so much product placement and stuff like that. And I was like, that was a key part of the storyline. That was a key narrative. The fact that the new dinosaur was created because sponsors wanted, like that, there's no mistake there. If you think they've accidentally, oh, you've seen through and they had some product placement, like that's a key narrative in that story. And again, similar there, that annoyance of the ultimate of capitalism was like, well, I've paid for this.
Yeah.
So it's like, but I've paid for this and it's extra large and I've only drunk half of it. It's like, that's part of it. That's key to it. I love that people assume that something goes through so many, and sometimes it does happen, but something goes through so many processes of writing, of being made, of this and that, and they're going to have put this in accidentally. Yes, do you know what I mean? It's like, mistake. Someone's probably thought, I know mistakes do happen, but in general, there's certain things that you're like, you're really as sitting there stroking your beard going, oh, I've just spotted this. It's like, you were meant to spot that, mate. Don't worry, it's not.
Oh, babe,
it's good. So what was your transition from getting so inspired by getting to be, a place set up by Lars von Trier and things like this to moving towards comedy?
Well, it went, so did that, then did a lot of film writing.
Because film is the opposite of what you were saying about what you love about podcasting, that you can do it all yourself. Oh, God, film is the opposite. It's the ultimate, any role you have in it, you're submitting to a load. If you're a writer, you can write a perfect script, and then you have to submit that to a director, an editor, and everything else.
That was almost what put me off it, because in order to work at Centropa, I don't know if it's still the same, it probably is, because they're a bit eccentric, Lars von Trier and Peter Ulbæk, who runs this place. Like, they have a pool, they have a tank just for fun. Amazing. They're these kind of very eccentric people. And And so you become a smutter, which is not a real word. It's just like a weird title they've made up, where you essentially work for free for maybe 6 months or a year.
Right.
And you're kind of signing up to being treated badly, and then you might be paid eventually. And, mm-hmm. you know, there were all these, again, like hoops you have to jump through, and you have to be very obedient. And I'm not obedient. I'm not good with authority. Right, I'm not good with having a boss. So I think that kind of faded out a bit, and then it became more about writing.
Yeah.
I would write so much that I would volunteer to do other people's homework just to have some writing to do.
Amazing.
And they loved that. And yeah, I loved it. I was like, thank you so much for letting me.
It's the perfect combination.
It was. It's the only reason I was a bit popular.
Yeah.
I remember being... it really saved me, because I lived with my family in like a ghetto in Denmark.
Yeah.
Like one of the only ghettos. Still not that bad. I remember walking home at night and then being stopped by this huge group of guys, like all wearing hoodies, and they were like ganging up on me, like pushing me into a corner. And then one of them went, "Oh wait, no wait, that's Sophie. She just did my poetry homework." And then they were like, "Oh Sophie, hey!" And I was like, "Amazing. Hi guys.
Has anyone got any homework that needs doing?"
Exactly. Please give me some work. So I would write a lot, and then that turned into me wanting to be a journalist.
Yeah.
And then I became an intern at a newspaper. I got to write full length, like full set, like articles, like not two page articles. And I was 15 at this point.
Oh wow!
And I got like a mentor called René Fredensborg in Denmark, who said to me that, "Oh, if you're one," he was kind of a radical guy. He got fired eventually for throwing a brick at the police to write like an opinion piece about how that felt.
Wow.
He's really cool.
That's amazing.
He's so cool. He wrote a book where he gave everyone fake names, but it was very easy to, it was about like drugs within the music industry, but everyone could tell he was just outing 100 different artists. He's incredible. So he basically said to me, "Listen, the people who go to journalist school are boring as fuck." Can I swear on this?
Yeah, swear all you like. Yeah, go to town.
So he's like, "They're boring as fuck. If you want to be a real good journalist, you go out and you live, like have life experience. You don't want to go to journalism school. They'll just teach you about commerce and you'll just end up writing like everyone else. So it's go amazing. Out and live." So I was like, "Oh, well, again, now I don't know what to do." So I would write and write and write. And then I had to get a job after school when I was 18. Then I had like a few years with depression and anxiety where I don't think I wrote anything, and I got into this relationship, and then I was just like in a dark hole for 3 or 4 years.
Right.
And when I came out on the other side, I got a job for UNICEF, being a fundraiser.
Right, yeah.
Where I met these amazing people, and I was bad at that job, very bad. Big apologies to UNICEF for the money I've cost them. And then I found another job in fundraising that I was really good at within the Danish Refugee Council and a Danish demining group. Mm-hmm. And between that, I worked for Amnesty, Red Cross Youth, all of these other organizations. So I became into everything was charity for a while.
Yeah.
And these non-governmental organizations and fundraising, and then that became my whole life for, I guess, 2 or 3 years, until I, through that, accidentally fell into comedy.
Right.
Before I saw live comedy when I was 21, it had never been an option. I'd never considered it. I'd never thought it would happen. I mean, I was 2 years into having done comedy before I realized it might be able to happen.
Right, yeah. This is actually a career.
Yeah.
There's. I mean, I love that as a story and as a journey, because you've found out what you want to do by doing loads of stuff. And that's such a rare thing these days, it seems. And I'm all for research and figuring things out. But I think one of the best ways to find anything is going out there and doing it and learning it. And then it's the things you fall into and the things you stumble upon, rather than, "I want to do this to get to here, to get to there, to get to there." It's like, well, just go and do some of it. Or even, "I could never do that."
Mm.
So I never want to hear that unless you've tried.
Mm.
If you've tried to do it and you can't, that's fine. I'm not someone who's saying that you're not allowed to fail or whatever else. It's like, but if you're telling me you can't do something and you've never tried it, it's like, fuck off. Like you don't know that. So I love that you've kind of jumped into all these different things and gone, "Let's try this out. Let's see if this works." Nope. It doesn't.
And a lot of it had to do with people as well.
Yeah.
So the second I found out, you know, the kind of people who were in the movie business, mm-hmm. it wasn't really a nice place to be. I mean, sure. The artists themselves, like the actual director, the actual scriptwriter, mm-hmm. they were wonderful people.
I mean, it's tough as well, because sometimes to be a great artist, you don't necessarily have to be a great person.
Yeah.
Or a great interactor.
But none of those things have ever, like, yeah. I was never fazed by whether or not people were kind. That was never a thing. Yeah. But were they interesting? Were they real? Yeah. Were they true? Were they honest? But people in journalism are not, inherently not necessarily neither interesting or, I mean, some of them are, of course, like my mentor, he was incredible, but the rest of the people I would meet were just, but then within fundraising, I met people who were in a very extreme sense of the word would die for a cause.
Yeah.
Because we would all sit there, and fundraising is one of the things that most people make fun of. The thing that everyone can somewhat, for some reason, agree is a disgraceful job, which is...
Right, yeah, that's
It baffles me, and it makes me so sad when people go,
yeah.
What do you call them here? You call them charity muggers.
Yeah.
And I was bad at being that in the street, so I was over the phone, and I was fucking good at it.
Yeah.
I was really, really good at it because I could turn off the empathy and just go, this is for the cause.
Yeah.
So I'd be a really, really good phone fundraiser. I ended up running a department.
Great.
And, but the people I met were all people, the people who would last, that is. We were all this, it felt like a little movement of people who were not fazed by people being rude, people being, bad people being so rich they didn't understand that there even were people out there being hungry.
Yeah.
And it felt like we'd been through a tiny, tiny war every single night. And then we sat down at 9 p.m. after our shifts and we were like, right, let's go get a drink. And just, today we've all together raised the amount of money it takes to clear a whole section of Darfur for landmines.
Yeah.
Let's go get a fucking drink.
Yeah. I think it's a fascinating area and world, and weirdly this is you shouldn't. I know my friend Indy because she's obsessed with Jurassic Park and works for Greenpeace, so it's just weird amazing. That each topic that's coming up I'm like, oh, that relates to someone I know. It's a fascinating, or I find the world of charity and fundraising a fascinating world, because it is like any other. I think there is good and there is bad, and I think there is conflicts as well. I think the thing that confuses me a lot, and this is knowing a lot of different people in different types of charities, is that for a lot of them to succeed and make the difference that they need to make, they need to be run like a business.
Mm.
And then running a charity like a business in some areas presents conflict and it's stuff that I become uncomfortable with. And it's, I always remember when my mum was working for the Samaritans, and she still does, that she wasn't, I did a lot of work with Calm, who are a men's mental health charity, and it was weird to talk to the people at Calm and see at that point, and again, everyone works together, but at that point, Calm kind of saw Samaritans as the enemy as a rival, and Samaritans saw Calm as a rival, and it's like, yo, you should be sharing a table at these events, and this should be a shared thing. And actually, I don't know if I've talked about it on the podcast, but I not had an argument, but I had a long back and forth with someone at Cancer Research, because they wanted me to be involved in a project they were doing, and I declined. Now, I've worked with cancer charities. It is something that means a lot to me. My granddad had leukemia and died of leukemia, but the thing that I kind of, the issue I had with Cancer Research, and this isn't an attack on Cancer Research at all, in fact I think I might have mentioned this in a recent podcast, and now it's going to sound like it is a constant attack on Cancer Research, but the issue that I had was, the thing that works for them to run it as a business is to divide cancer up. Because the argument I made was, I do research on anything if I'm going to be involved in positive or negative. And I found that pancreatic cancer, had one of the highest death rate percentages, and had one of the lowest amount of funding. Whereas breast cancer and testicular cancer, huge amounts of funding, a huge rates of success now, which is great. But it's because the campaigns are easier to get behind. The pink, the walk for breast cancer and things like that. And I put that to them, and the woman at Cancer Research, again, not a bad person in any way, doing what she thinks is the best way to do things. If I don't agree, that's just a difference in opinion. But her feeling was, if you've lost your mum to breast cancer, you're going to be more inclined to engage in this, and so on and so forth, which I got. But my argument was, but that's because you've given that option. If the option was just to support cancer, you wouldn't go, well, my mum died specifically of breast cancer, so I'm not... Do you know what I mean? So my feeling was that because it was run like a business, because that was ways of making it work, was you're getting competitive, you're having different campaigns, you're having different social media challenges, it meant that things were falling behind the wayside because they didn't have as good a marketing team or as good a marketing thing and things like that. So it was,
That's why, because I'm trying to imagine if we had done that in at the Danish Refugee Council, because we would get people on the phone saying, oh, can I only support white kids?
Right.
Or stuff like that, or people saying, but I've heard that you give money to, what do you call, like roadblocks? Yeah. You know, like sometimes you'll just have people who, like little soldier cliques standing by roadblocks demanding money for you to pass.
Right.
And then it's such a big thing having to explain, say, no, this is like this goes into a big pot, and then there are really clever people who decide
where these money. Best,
and yes, if sometimes some money has to go to people who don't deserve, because that's how the world works. You can't not help an entire village just because you don't want to give £5 to a soldier who's a bad guy.
Yeah,
and because that's the problem with trying to make people. Because when you have to make people donate to something like that, you kind of do have to make them feel involved in somehow. Like this is all on you. You can make this huge change.
Yeah.
But then they also want to have a say in it, and you're like, no, you have to.
You have to trust us to be the experts in it.
And the cause of Danish Refugee Council, which is Dansk Flygtningehjælp, if anyone from Denmark is listening, was the CEO, the guy who ran the whole thing. He came in and he always rode his bicycle. He's this amazing guy.
Yeah.
And he's old white hat man. Oh, probably not old. He's white hat. He's a man. He came into the office and on the first day, he said to me and the other people starting, he just went, our goal is for us to not exist. Right. That's what we want to do.
Yeah,
when we're done, we don't need to exist anymore, and then we'll all be happy. I was like, fucking great. Yeah. That's amazing.
Yeah, that's perfect. That's again, it's a perfect outlook. It's that you're trying to solve a problem. It's one of the things I love. I did a podcast with Greenpeace, and they're another one that people will love and hate. People have conflict. Mm. And there's been certain things I haven't agreed with them and certain things I have. But one of the things I loved hearing about was kind of off the record was the amount of stuff that they amount of problems that they solved without a big public campaign because of the power they have and the good that they've done. There's a lot of companies that they will contact and say, look, because of what you're doing here, you're kind of next on our list. We're kind of giving you a chance to sort it out.
Amazing.
And they'd solve it. So it wouldn't be, it's not that kind of, again, I think the issue that some people have with charities is they fear it's just a load of people trying to pat themselves on the back and go, look at the good that we're doing. It's like, they solve loads of problems without anyone ever knowing about it. Just going,
oh yeah,
look, we're coming for you next. And that just, I loved how gangster it felt. It's like,
oh yeah,
just by the way, you're next on our list. You sort your shit out. All right, we'll stop that.
Yeah.
And I love that.
And it was a sport as well. It felt like it felt like for good. I mean, I believe every single person in that call center where I started out, where I worked for a few years, every single one of those people could have become so rich if they'd worked in somewhere where they got permission.
Commission.
Commission.
Yes.
Second language.
It's all good.
But we just got like the hourly rate depending on what we got.
Yeah.
And I would see some of these people just sweat. I would see two people sitting opposite each other just on the phone, just trying. Oh, and it would excite me so much seeing these like giants just use their words and their tonation to put the point across.
Yeah.
I remember seeing one guy called Mark, who's also the boss. We had this day where the bosses took the phones, which is kind of like a motivation thing of, oh no, even we're doing it.
Yeah.
It always worked. Because we got to hear how they did it. So we'd be like, ooh, let's see if we can pick something up. And I did, because this guy called Mark was on the phone with this woman, and he was really trying, and you could just hear she kept saying no. And then you could see him, and he like arched his back, and he leaned back, and he just went, apparently I haven't been making myself clear enough. And then he said something along the lines of, there are people dying. You can help. Please help.
Amazing.
And then it was silence for a while, and then he started typing in her information. So she'd just gone, duh. Yep. Yeah, good point. Yep,
you're right. Good point. You've done that.
And it was just in his tonation, and it was in his, oh, I was so excited by it.
Yeah. It's a weird one. And again, I think you're right in highlighting it in British culture in particular. I mean, that's all I can speak of on this particular subject, is we do, it's easy to have a default of, oh no.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean? Because there are a lot of different, and again, I think it's part of the issue can be that there's so many causes, and that's not the fault of any of the foundations or whatever else.
Yeah,
it's like,
or the way
the fact there's so many causes is means there's a lot of bad stuff going on in the world. Yeah. So it's a shame. But,
or even better, there's so much opportunity for you to feel really good about yourself.
Yeah. Yeah, completely.
To make,
but I think
because
of that, it can make people become a little bit. My automatic response is, no, I'm sorry.
Yeah, of
course. No, I'm busy.
Yeah.
And that's a shame, because you don't get to
to
see all of it. I have on social media, I explain to people a lot. I have people ask me to push certain causes, and I explain to them, I can't, because if I get behind two or three causes a year that mean something to me, people will react to it. If I post a cause every week, people will ignore all of them. So I'd rather have an effect on two or three than
have all of them ignored.
But I look like such a nice guy because Pip's pushing another cause coming. So it's finding the balance right of making that work, of getting through to the right people at the right time, I guess.
Yeah,
it's a weird one. So how did you? Again, so how did that turn into, or how did you come out of that and into comedy? Was you saw comedy for the first time around that?
So I loved comedy. I've always loved, like, the first time I saw comedy, I was 10 years old, I saw it on TV, and I was crying with laughter. And then throughout my depression, watching comedy was the only thing that could get me out of bed. Was
amazing.
Just to,
what kind of thing were you into? Was it?
It's all
is there a big Danish scene? Yeah,
not big, but it was there, and there were loads of DVDs and stuff that I bought. The only English speaking ones, I think, it was Ricky Gervais, and Ellen DeGeneres.
Yeah,
I think were the only American ones English speaking ones I saw, and I loved that. Oh, Ellen DeGeneres and like Ricky Gervais's bit about the animals about to go on board the Noah's Ark.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
All comedy just made me cry with laughter. Most of it was the Danish comedians.
Yeah.
But again, it wasn't even
viable.
It wasn't. Yeah.
Yeah.
It never ever became about me. It was just me watching it laughing. And then when I was working at the Danish Refugee Council, there was a girl who started working there. And she was hilarious. She was so funny. And I was crying with laughter at everything she said. And we went out for drinks after a day. And I spoke to her. And she said, I said I loved comedy. And she said, oh, well, my boyfriend's a comedian. And I was like, well, which one is he? Because I know all five of them. And she was like, no, there's actually a lot of them.
There's others. Yeah.
And I said, oh, really? And she said, yeah, you can come by. There's an open mic. And I didn't even know what an open mic was. But She was really bad at her job, and I'd been helping her a lot because she was so funny. I liked her.
Yeah.
So I was helping her and helping her, causing them to lose a lot of money, probably. I really liked her. And then she owed me one. She said, well, this is actually a volunteer job because this is open mic where people work and it's all the profits go to Save the Children.
Yeah.
So you can put it on your CV. So, but you, what you're doing is you're just manning the door watching comedy. So yeah. Everyone wants this particular volunteer job.
Yeah, amazing.
But I actually run this whole thing so I can get you in because my boyfriend's a comedian.
Oh, fantastic. Da, 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 da. Yeah, yeah.
So she got me a job at this open mic. And the first time I went, I can't even, I laughed so much that I was, I couldn't even, this whole world of, like, it was right by my doorstep. There was these open mics where these people I had never seen before, but they were funny.
Yeah.
Were just going up on stage, making the jokes that I'd had to see on a DVD, and this was just happening every single day. Oh, oh my, like my mind was blown, and yet didn't cross my mind at all until I sat backstage with some of the, with the comedians, just being very quiet, listening. And then one of them said, oh, I saw you do that joke again. Did you rewrite it? And then the other one said, yeah, I wrote some new lines. And I went, excuse me, wrote? You don't just go up there and
yeah,
talk?
And be funny, yeah.
And they said, no, no, we write our jokes. And then my head exploded, and they said, no, there are books. You can learn how to write comedy. And I bought all of them. They're like 16 joke books called Horrible Things, like the Joke Bible and How to Do Comedy, How to Become a Comedian. And I read all of them,
yeah.
And I just started writing because I write. I've always been a writer. I've always written. So that was like a combination of, oh, my God, this is a thing.
I love that if it feels like you... It feels like you getting in there was another scam. In that, like when you were at school and they were like, "Oh, I like writing. I'll do your homework." If it feels like she's gone, well, you've got this a job on the door, but you kind of have to do it for free. But it's a favour. You're like, I'll do it for free. I'll do it for free. It's like great. They're getting a free employee, and you get to get in there again.
Oh,
I love
but
that.
But it felt like such a gift. Yeah. It felt like the biggest gift.
Amazing.
Because then I thought this is my this is perfect.
Yeah.
I can go home every night. I can write these jokes, which I now realize I love to do.
Yeah.
So I would write like 16 pages of jokes, and I would go to these open mics every single night, and just to hang out with comedians, just to be close to them, to watch the comedy, and then afterwards just stand near them.
Yeah.
I was so annoying. I mean, they'll all attest to this publicly. I was so fucking annoying. Just kept just standing there, and then they would be like having drinks, having a chat. I'd be like, excuse me, tell me more about comedy.
Yeah.
And I was so desperate to hear them talk about the craft and how to, and I remember calling friends of mine to tell them about new joke formats I'd found. I remember calling a friend of mine just saying the words, someone just used silence as a punchline.
Amazing.
I was so obsessed with this.
I can imagine the annoyance, but also joy and excitement, because all of these industries are similar in that everyone doing it doesn't 100% know what they're doing, but if they get the opportunity to pretend they know exactly what they're doing, it's perfect. So they're probably up there thinking, I'm not really sure. Then when someone's saying, so how did that... Well, let me teach you a thing or two. Explain this, you know, it's that beauty of it.
Well, that's the interesting part, is this is Denmark, meaning that there's only so few places. So,
right.
I mean, back then there'd be one open mic from Monday to Thursday, and then there'd be the comedy club that had Friday and Saturday. So these were the big comedians.
Yeah,
these were the famous comedians.
Yeah, these are the guys.
Because there's only one place they can go.
Right, yeah,
so I did actually go up to our version of Ricky Gervais and go, excuse me, talk to me about it.
Yeah.
And so often they'd say, sorry, I'm just here with my colleague. We're just having a chat. We've just done a show. We've just been at work. So
you're in our workplace right now.
And I would just do anything to be near them, be it, you know, I bought a camera to take pictures of them, to be near them, to be like, oh, let me take your press photos. I thought you just needed a fancy camera to take good photos.
Yeah, yeah.
And I tried that. Tried sleeping with them. That worked. I tried to do it until after a few months, one of them was like, listen, you have to start doing comedy because that's clearly what you want.
Yeah.
That's why you're here. And I was like, no, oh, no, it's not. No, I just love comedy. And he was like, fine, on Tuesday, you have 5 minutes. You're doing 5 minutes at this open mic.
Amazing.
That's it. And then that's a challenge. I can't say no to that.
Yeah.
So I did it. I was like forced into it. And then it was just...
And how'd the first 5 minutes go?
I think it went well. It went well because audiences are nice.
Yeah.
And I've always been good or had like a clear potential to become good.
Right.
Like I think the very first time I realized that it was a written thing, I spent 2 months just watching comedy, taking notes.
Amazing, yeah.
And not in a, like, figuring out why are things funny.
Yeah.
Why is this funny? Why did they laugh at that? How did he fix that from last week? So I did kind of study it and learn how to write jokes, yeah. Which, of course, is not everything you need to be able to do to become a comedian. But I was good from the beginning.
Yeah.
But of course, in the way that new comedian
it's
is.
It's good, though. It's putting in that work. It's something we discussed on your podcast, was the fact that it's the goal isn't just the getting on stage.
Oh, that was never...
The goal
I hated
is
that bit.
Crafting and getting something really good that you're then excited to share on stage. I have people ask me a lot of advice or to read their poetry and stuff like that. And I always have to say, I'm no expert on poems at all, so I can't really help you. But my feeling is, if you're excited to share it, it's probably good.
Yeah.
If you're sitting there thinking, then it's probably... I'm not there yet. All my experience with writing has been... I'll come up with something and be like, I need to get this out. And it's that excitement to share it that tells you it's probably half decent and going to work, hopefully.
Absolutely. The stage was never a thing. Yeah. I never wanted it. I never liked being, the first 2 or 3 years I did comedy, and this sounds like, I don't think people believe me when I say this, but I do mean it. I constantly had to fight the need to look behind me to see what they were looking at.
Right.
It felt amazing. So strange that it was me. Because I kept being, this is odd. but it was such a thrilling, and also again with the people, I'd found my people.
Yeah.
And ironically, around that time, one of my grandfathers had died, and I wasn't in no way close to him. But something a bit, and the reason why I say ironically is because I'm only now talking about this in my new show, this particular funeral.
Oh, wow.
But something that I found really funny happened at this funeral. And I thought it was hilarious. And I tried to tell all my girlfriends, and they all thought I was weird and annoying and why this isn't funny. And, oh, my God, I'm so sorry about your grandfather. I'm like, no, that's not the point. This really funny thing happened.
Yeah.
And then I'd been so frustrated by telling all my friends about this, and none of them had laughed. And then I told a backstage area full of comedians, and they all laughed, and I was like, my people.
Yeah.
This is it. This is where I've always meant to be.
Yeah.
Every time I've been weird, it's just because these people have been out there.
Yeah.
And they would have understood me every time someone else didn't.
Yeah.
So I just found my place, and I found people who could talk to me the way I needed to be talked to. So after my very first gig, everyone went from that open mic to the comedy club where some other comedians were. And I was just standing by the bar feeling like I had so much energy. My hands were shaking. I was like, I can't believe what just happened. I was just on stage. It was like the biggest adrenaline rush. And one of the comedians found out. Someone said, oh, did you hear Sophie debuted? And he was like, oh, really? He just knew me as this annoying person who was always there. He was like, oh, she's there again. And then he was like, wait, you debuted? And I was like, yes. And then he just grabbed me and dragged me into the hallway. And he went, okay, right, these are the things you need to know. And he just gave me like 5 top tips. Like,
oh, wow.
Never say no to a spot. You have to try and gig every single night. Keep writing your jokes. But do the same material over and over again until it's absolutely bulletproof, perfect. He had all these weird things like never do a joke twice. If it doesn't work the first time, scrap it. Write a new one, which he's not right about. But I didn't know that. And he just had all of these, like, do this, never take a break from comedy, because if you can do that, there are other people out there who want it more than you, and then they deserve the stage time more than you. And he just gave me all, and then he went, when's your next spot? And I was like, I hadn't even considered next spot.
Yeah.
Like, I was just had this life-changing experience.
Yeah, yeah, yeah,
so he grabbed, he was quite famous, so he grabbed another comedian, and he went, oh, you're emceeing this gig on Thursday, right? He was like, yes, put Sophie on. He was like, okay. He grabbed another guy, you're emceeing that thing on Tuesday, right? Yeah, put Sophie on. They're like, okay. And he was like, fine, you have your next 2 gigs. Now fill the rest of your diary.
Amazing.
And it was just... And I was like, yes, this is what I need. I need this. I need something where I know exactly how to do, and it's hard work. It takes, like, stamina, it takes emotional calmness, it takes, you know, this is a thing that's going to make me cry, it's a thing that's going to make me hate myself, it's a thing that's going to be so painful, and I'm going to fucking love it.
Yeah, I love that. I love I've always been a big fan of that outlook of kind of congratulations, what's next?
Oh,
kind
yeah.
of rather than I've just yeah. all right, cool, what's after that?
Yeah.
Kind of, I'm a big believer in celebration can be a negative thing, because it can be you going, yeah, look what I've achieved. It's like, yeah. right, well, you should have achieved that because you're really good.
Yeah.
Like, that shouldn't be a big deal. That should just be, that's what you do. What are you going to achieve next?
Yeah,
and keep climbing. Yeah. exactly.
And the Danish comedy circuit was amazing for that, because they all...
It must be perfect if it's that small, that it is that kind of, you can link and get around that circuit in a really... Or
back
quite
then,
quickly.
It was magic. Back then, I'm saying back then because I don't know how it is now.
Yeah.
But back then it was magical, because they all knew me, and some of them kind of liked me and some of them kind of hated me because I was so annoying all the time. And then when they started seeing me on stage, because in Denmark at that point, not a lot of people knew about comedy.
Yeah.
So an audience would always be 50-50. 50% of people had never seen comedy before. So when you go on stage, not only do you have to convince them that stand-up is funny,
mm-hmm.
but then you also have to convince them that, stand-up, who's not that guy you know from TV, is funny.
Yeah.
And then if you're a woman, also women are funny.
Yeah.
So it's a lot harder work.
There's a lot of processes to get along,
Yeah, they're so... hesitant because it's so new.
The set and setting is something that gets overlooked a lot, I think, as part of the art and craft of comedy. And you've touched upon it twice there, in that you told a story of a funeral around for friends and it didn't work. You told it to comedians or in a club, and it brings the house down. And I think comedy, particularly on any slightly on the edge subjects, we need to be told that we're allowed to laugh at it in advance, or that we can laugh at it in advance. And it makes a huge difference. And comedy clubs are an example of that. If you're familiar with comedy clubs, again, if it's a Danish scene where people aren't really sure what stand-up is, then...
Yeah, especially because these were open mics. So people were... It was just in a basement and there are people talking on the stage and... Why are they not dancing?
Yeah.
Why are they not wearing silly hats?
And that's it. I think there's a lot to be said, and I think it's the same with music, that I really enjoyed doing festivals as well as my own tours, because my own tour, not that it's easy, but people have spent money and invested in the fact they're going to have a good time. So chances are, as long as you don't fuck up completely, they're going to have a good time, if you know what I mean. They're so invested in that fact, we've come out, we really want to enjoy this, so let's enjoy it. It is a bit in London, but you don't get that many people who are like, I've paid, let's see what they can do. It's more, I've spent my money, let's go and enjoy it. Whereas again, if you're on a night out and you're like, well, I don't know what's going to happen here, it's a different audience to try and win over. And it's the same with a festival, I guess. If they're like, I've seen 30 bands this weekend, who are these guys? Impress me. I like having to win people over there, as well as that kind of easier gig.
That's why I love, you know, very early stage work in progress shows.
Yeah.
Because it's almost even worse, because there will be people coming who are like, oh my God, I love you. I've seen all of your shows and I've heard of your podcast and I love you. And I'm like, oh God, but if you're not a comedy fan, you're about to just hear me talk for an hour.
Because this isn't what you're...
This isn't
a polished set.
Yeah, you need to understand that that other show you just saw was a
year. Tough as well, because works in progress shows have such a scale that it will be a work in progress right up until it's a show. And I remember going to see one of Ramesh Ranganathan's works in progress, and it was just before it was the show. So it was so spot on. I was like... This feels unfair for anyone who this is their first time going to see a work in progress, because it was just before Edinburgh. So I was like, you're going to go and see another one tomorrow. And as you said, it's going to be someone kind of talking a bit and figuring it out. Whereas a Ramesh is one at that point. It pretty much had all the beats in. It pretty much had it all there. I was like, oh man, I feel it was an amazing night, an amazing show. I feel you've screwed over whoever's on next. Doing their work in progress, because you've just come out and performed an actual an actual gig. So how did you find yourself in the UK with your comedy and performing?
There was
and in a different scene as well, not the Denmark scene that's so intricate and interconnected. A scene that's got London, that's one whole world,
and then it's got
everywhere else around the UK.
Oh my God! And then there's the festival scene, there's the comedy club scene, there's the alternative scene, there's straight stand-up scene, there's the new gen. I mean, well, it happened because I'd done comedy in English like once or twice in Denmark. There was this once every other month or so that there'll be someone doing an English show. And I tried that a few times, and that had gone quite well, and I really enjoyed it. But then I had my heart broken by this guy who was a musical theater actor, and he played Mark in Rent. Amazing. And he broke my heart. And because he was a musical theater actor, I was like, fuck you. I'm going to go to London, and I'm going to see all the musicals that you love.
Amazing.
Because I thought that would make me win for some weird reason.
I love it.
So I went to, I booked, I used the money I had to, I should have paid rent with. And I booked, I booked a couch surfing like a week in London, and booked all the matinee musical thing, like Les Mis, Wicked, all of them, Blood Brothers. And then I was like, oh, well, I'll have the evenings off I guess I could try and see if there are any spots going. I could do one or two spots. And I ended up filling that whole week. So every single night I would do an open mic spot. Like, just like the most easiest ones to get. But I didn't know anything about that.
But they are about hugely. Like, it always stuns me just talking to all my comedian mates that they're like, yeah, I'll do 5 or 6 or 7 a week. That's just...
easy. And so I found some of them, So I just went here and watched the musicals and did the spots. And I remember going back home, just standing in the tube station in Denmark, being like, I was still having my suitcase, and I thought, how do I get back? I need to get back. And then I went back a month later, and it was all I thought about was just going back and meeting the people again and doing the same gigs again.
Yeah.
And that was a 10-day trip where I had an Airbnb in Brixton, and about 4 or 5 days into that, I thought, how would one find a flat here?
Yeah.
And then I went on Gumtree, and then I went, how does it look from the inside? So I went to this place in Manor House, Arsenal Tube, Arsenal Stadium, and I went to see this house, and I felt really sneaky. They don't even know that that I'm not planning on moving here. They don't know that I'm just scouting. And I was like, they were like, oh, so how long are you staying? I was like, oh, yeah, I'm moving here. And I was like, oh, those bloody believers. And I saw this whole house, and I was like, oh, this is really interesting. This is how you live in England. And then they said, you can have it if you want. Do you want it? And I said, yes. And they're like, oh, cool. And I signed the contract. And all this happened. I was like in a haze, almost paralyzed. And I went to the ATM, and I pulled out all the money I had in my account that just covered the deposit, and I handed it over to them, and they're like, oh, great, so when are you going to bring your stuff over? And I was like, oh, now. So I went back to the Airbnb and packed my suitcase and took it back to this house, and like told the Airbnb lady that I'm moving out now because now I live in London. And I just sat on this bed in this 3-story house on the top floor with next to my red suitcase. I was like, oh no, I just moved to London.
I mean, that's a hell of an afternoon, isn't it? Just
it happened quite quickly.
I love that. That's amazing.
And then I called my mom. I was like,
by the way, I live in England now. Yeah.
Can you send over some money?
I love the swiftness of that. Not really any. Maybe I should do. It's like, oh no, it's happened.
It's just happened.
I'm here.
Yeah, and it was everything. Everything happened like that. It would be me walking down the street, passing a Lloyd's, going, oh, let me just try. And I went into the Lloyd's going, can I have a bank account? And they're like, do you have a password? I was like, here we go. Yeah. Oh, here's your account. I was like, okay, I have an account.
Yeah.
And I then, love it. Yeah, so then I just lived here. And then it was just day by day trying to survive and eating porridge. And
I love that. Just walking literally from each next bit to bit. So, what do you need? Some money? Okay, I'll go and see if I can get some money. Can I have some money? Yep. Okay. This works.
A lot of walking to gigs, even though it was like an hour and a half walk, because I couldn't afford the bus fare or whatever.
It's good though. It's what I love about London. I think is a really underrated part of London is the bulk of it is walkable. Mm. I know it's an hour or 90 minutes, but if it's not. Or even if it is tipping down, if you've got an umbrella, it's nice. I like to walk around London as much as possible.
I'm looking back at it now because as like a really nice romantic thing, because now I'm not as hungry as I was. But I just that whole buying like a £1 frozen pizza and that being my meal for the day, and sometimes treating myself to a can of Coke as well, and going intense. To these gigs. and just doing comedy every night. Sometimes I could double up. Once they'd earned my, once I'd earned their trust, they would allow me to double up. And oh my God. And then I'd meet a comedian who would show me a new club I hadn't heard about and new comics I had never seen before. And it was just the best.
So were you welcomed into the scene quite swiftly?
Yeah, I feel so. Yeah.
Are there any people you met early on that have that stick in your mind or that help guide you in?
Yeah, there's a some of the first people I met was a Canadian guy called Peter White, who I think he's back in Canada now.
Yeah.
And they were the first. So I moved in properly because that was like way too expensive, that place. Poor. So once I'd gone back home to clear my flat and to move properly, which took me about a month to get everything sorted and close down stuff, I moved properly to Streatham Common with a guy called Dave Millett, who's a Canadian comic who's now back in Canada, who's one of the best comedians I've ever seen. He was magic. And then a guy called Peter White, also a Canadian comic back in Canada. And then Evelyn Mark, who's she's doing her first show this year in Edinburgh. She was a Swedish comedian. So we'd met probably on the first night I did stand-up in English in Copenhagen.
Yeah.
Because they had to have Swedish comedians over to do English comedy because no one else was doing it. And then we got talking in Denmark and I said I was moving. So she was like, I'll move too.
I'll do it. Let's go. Yeah.
So we moved together to this house in Streatham.
I love that. I love the kind of the pulling together and unity of it all as well in that nerve wracking rather than any competitiveness kind of everyone going, let's go and do this, let's all do comedy, let's make it work.
And there's a bit of, I mean, because I moved here, because I was in the country for about 6 months before Evelyn Mark moved over, for me I always had a weird kind of sense of entitlement because I was like, I was here first kind of thing. So I was a bit of, she's probably the only one where I've felt competitive with, which has always just been a destructive thing and something I definitely do not feel good about. But apart from with her, oh my God, the whole thing was just full of amazing people and just everything was so new. And even then, same with everything else in my life, I had no goals. I wasn't like, well, I'm going to do Edinburgh, I'm going to get an agent, because I didn't know what those things were.
Yeah,
I just knew that there were gigs here in London, and then at some point people started saying Edinburgh as if it was a thing and not just not a place.
And you're like, right, well, that's something. I'll find out about this.
How do I do Edinburgh?
Yeah.
Do I just go there? What is it? And then I tried to learn all these things, but I think I was just poor, gigging for free for a year and a half or something, just trying to get by on money from the Danish educational system.
Yeah, and then it finally turns around. Well, before we get to the end, I'm looking at how...
Yeah, I talk a lot.
We're going. before we get to the end, I want to get to the thing that... I'm sure it's what first brought you to my attention. I'd say last year, I guess, was that when you started to put together tours that were... anxiety friendly as such? Is that the
I say anxiety is safe, but neither are completely correct.
And the point of that being, obviously I'll let you explain more, but there are an increasing amount of people that do have a lot of anxiety and restrictions on their nights out due to anxiety and due to mental health issues or physical issues or all these other things. And rather than simply, again, it's a reasonably simple thing to say, oh, all the venues have got a disabled access, but to pick venues and gigs that are anxiety safe, it can be a case of providing areas at the back or to the side that aren't within all the crowd, or balconies and so on and so forth. So what is the process and what makes an anxiety safe gig?
Well, it's not a promise, but what I've said is there's an email address, which used to be a horrible Gmail address. Now it's tour@sophiehagen.com, where if you're coming to one of my gigs, you can email me and we'll figure it out.
Yeah.
So, because that's one of the things I learned pretty quickly is everyone's anxiety is different.
Yeah.
And you can't plan that. I've had people ask me.
And that can kind of be all it takes is just to have some questions answered.
Yeah, some people say,
I mean, as simple as that, of knowing, this is what the venue is, okay.
Yes, exactly. I've had people say, and also someone just said, so someone wanted to know if I said a specific word that was very triggering to them.
Mm-hmm.
It's just the mentioning of that particular word.
Wow, yeah, that's fascinating.
And I didn't, but I talked about the topic surrounding it, so I said to them, it comes at this point in the show, this is the context, this is the story that I'm going to tell. I'm 99% sure I won't say the word. Some people tell me that they might have to leave for whatever reason, mm-hmm. either a physical thing or a mental thing, psychological thing, but they wouldn't be able to leave if they thought that I would think that they were being rude.
Yeah.
They were like, I'm going to leave, but just so you know, it's not about you. Yeah, just, that's all they needed to tell me.
Yeah.
People have needed a seat by the aisle, a seat by the wall, a seat in the close to the stage, far from the stage, close to the exit. Sometimes I let people walk in before the audience if they mm-hmm. don't like being in a crowd or feeling mm-hmm. that stress of having to find a seat quickly. So I would go out and meet them outside of the door and let them in 10 minutes before the audience so they could find the seat. So I had a lot of those. I think those are...
It's great because they're all kind of small and achievable things on your part, but huge things to the individual that is having the anxiety over them. And as I said, I mean, people I know who've suffered from anxiety with social events or gigs or whatever else, again, as much of it can be, just knowing someone telling you that the venue's all right in this way or in that way, or this is okay or this is that, and it's like, all right, well, that's cool then.
Otherwise, they may not have
made it in the front door because of that complete panic of, I don't... There probably isn't going to be this particular issue, but I don't know for certain, therefore...
Yeah, and then there's the added thing of... because I thought of this quite late last year when I did my first UK tour. Mm-hmm. So I think I made sure that every single venue was anxiety safe, but I also wanted gender neutral toilets in all the mm-hmm. venues. And it was too late to demand it. So only some of the venues were. But this, my next tour, which starts this autumn, all the venues are anxiety safe. I mean, you can email me. All the venues have gender neutral toilets and they're all have disabled access, which is sadly so difficult.
Yeah.
But we did it. But
it's the problem, not the problem, but one of the issues encountered by comedy and music becoming so much more viable as careers because of the internet and because of things like that. You can tour without it being a stadium tour, without it being this and that. But part of the problem, and for bands as well, but part of the problem with that becomes that you're going to be in venues that weren't necessarily built originally for performance, for audience, for this kind of thing. Buildings that have been adapted, or some chairs have been slung in, or a mic's been slung in, or whatever else. Therefore, it is easy to find a lot of venues that haven't got the correct access, haven't got this or that, because it's not been the plan at the start. It's not that they're evil or horrible. It's that they've gone, we've got a room, we can put some comedy in there. They've not gone, we've got a room, we can put some comedy, and we can keep the disabled out. It's like, that's not what they've done. They've tried to be nice about it, but it's not always ideal.
And some venues have been so nice, and they've... cringe-worthingly nice. Some of them have been like, oh, no, but we can hire people to carry people down the stairs. And I was like, no, God, no.
That's not going to work
please
out.
Don't. Yeah. So we've had to say no, but they've meant so well, which is kind of heartwarming. But the gender-neutral toilets is part of the anxiety as well. So everything kind of becomes a bit about the anxiety as well. Like the disabled access also has to do with anxiety because it's not always... So the gender neutral toilets, I've had quite a few emails from people saying that that would have kept them from going. And that is due to the anxiety about, for example, being a trans person walking into a gendered toilet.
I'd imagine not because of your crowd, but have you encountered anyone who has anxiety in reaction to the gender neutral toilets?
I've had
that's an odd one, and it's a double-edged sword.
But... No, I know exactly what you mean. I've had a few people with, American profiles that haven't liked my page or my follow me on Twitter, so I think we'd call them trolls,
who
did go, well, I'm scared of the gender-neutral toilets. And I've just said the same thing to them as I said to everyone else, which is, okay, well, if you have an anxiety about attending this gig, you can email me with the show you're attending, we'll figure it out.
Yeah,
because we'll there will be other toilets, you know, there might be a backstage toilet, or maybe I can get the staff to find somewhere else for you, I can walk you to a pub nearby, you know, we'll figure it out if that is a true... But no one's ever... And then from the people... the only reaction I've gotten that was kind of negative was someone saying it was really annoying that all of a sudden the queue to the like the toilets without urinals was longer because men would rather get in that line.
Right.
All of a sudden everyone wanted to go to the clean toilet, I think was what she said. But again, small price to pay.
Yeah.
So I've had, there are a lot of people who got upset, but no one who would have come and attended a show of mine.
Yeah.
Because I like to believe that my audience are quite empathetic and they get that a toilet isn't a, it's not a safe space.
And it's a fascinating thing because it's, that issue highlighted there wouldn't be an issue if we were several years down the line and toilets were put in as gender neutral, rather than the fact in reality you're turning male and female toilets into gender neutral toilets.
I make the signs myself. I make them with the little colour. They're colourful and sweet.
You've not searched which comedy clubs have gender. You know, you're making
impossible.
Them gender neutral for the show. So it's. It's making the best of a not ideal situation there. So
it's
interesting to hear that the one issue that's come up. It's like, well, that wouldn't be an issue if the venues truly if we were in the future and we truly just had gender neutral toilets, then that wouldn't be.
It's that thing of the thing I always have to say is it's always safety over comfort. I know it's not always the most comfortable thing having to. Poo next to a guy who's cute if you're a heterosexual woman, cis woman or whatever.
Yeah.
But again, there are people who feel unsafe.
Yeah.
Because of the way they from how they pass or from their gender, if they're trans or whatever, they feel unsafe. So I don't care how uncomfortable this makes you.
Yeah.
We all have to just, just keep it together and survive this one toilet trip.
That gets me with everything that kicked off over it in America with laws changing and changing back and so on and so forth. It's like, well, the main argument seemed to be, I don't want my daughter having to share toilets with someone who was born a man. And my kind of argument is always, they're not. You're in a cubicle. In that situation, the issue was always men or people born with male genitalia using female toilets. So female toilets aren't like men's, where you're all they're together. You're in individual cubicles anyway. So I genuinely have never understood that argument or that fear. It's like
it's all transphobia. There's so much. The transphobic arguments are so silly and so. I mean, almost makes me feel sick. Like
the thing that kills me is I've heard intelligent people who are liberal people go, yeah, but I get the fear of this. It's like, no, you're not. And particularly with that argument in America was they were saying, I don't want some pervert to just be able to put on a dress and sneak in. It's like, well, number one, that's not how it works. With that law, you have to be legally. So it would be some pervert. In your mind, who's gone through a lot of stuff to live in a certain way for a certain amount of time to get this legal all to poo next to your child. Again, it's not going to happen. And number two, as horrible and intimidating and scary as it is, as a man, if I want to, right now I can get up and walk into the Witherspoons across the road and go into the women's toilet.
Exactly.
There's not security on the door. There's not this or that.
Yeah.
I could go and do that and do something horrendous. I'm not going to, obviously.
Yeah.
I'm not obese, but it's protecting against something that you can't protect against anyway.
This isn't
a sudden new issue.
It's directly dangerous if we start believing that toilets are safe spaces.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
we always have, as women, we always have to be on on like, on watch and on guard and be careful. We can't, none of us go to a public toilet and just relax. Like, oh, thank God, now I don't have to put my keys between my fingers all the time and hope to not get attacked. Like, that's just not how the world works. And again, it's always safety over comfort. So, I mean, that's just how, and I need to give credit where credit's due, which is the Spook School. I don't know if you know them, the band. No. Really cool queer band. They're so cool.
Yeah.
And they did it. They had the gender neutral toilets on their tour because one or two members are non-binary and the rest of them are queer. I'm not really sure about the statistics of the band, but they're
a
really cool, awesome band.
Yeah.
So they did that on their tour and that's how I got the idea. And then from that I went, oh, well, you know, the anxiety thing. And then so that was my last tour, was the anxiety and the gender neutral toilets. And then from that a few people said, what about disabled access? And I was like, well, yeah, I'm a jerk. I'm a able-bodied jerk. I hadn't even thought of that, of course. And then this tour, I did that. And then and at the same time, trying to keep the ticket prices as low as I possibly can and trying to, you know, I have a trigger warning on my new show, which is a new thing as well, which I didn't, well, I had never expected a show to necessarily need that, but I didn't think I would make a show that would need a trigger warning, but... It's just trying to be as, I guess, inclusive or.
And again, it's the anyone that would give a backlash of, oh, it's being over PC, over careful. It's not. It's small things that are very manageable and not a big deal to make those changes at all.
Then don't buy a ticket. Like you're not welcome.
Exactly. it's not something that's a hard thing to change or these things to do. And again, I'm a fan of the trigger warning thing. And again, people go against that. It's like, no, I think trigger warnings are important because I don't think comedy should be censored. But I think people have genuine issues that it's not that they're, oh, you shouldn't say it. It's like people have been through stuff in their life that no matter how much they think, oh, you should still be allowed to joke about that, whatever, it's like, but they can't be in the room when that's happening because of their personal reactions. That's not...
Yeah.
You're not then being overly... Again, if you were to go, I'm removing all... If you had all this material and you removed it all from your set, then maybe I'd say, well, that's a shame because comedy should be this and comedy should be that. But...
Yeah, and that would have also
the use
felt...
of trigger warnings is...
Yeah, and no one's screamed at me. You know, I've had a few audience... I think three or four audience members came up to me after a show and said, you know, they liked it, they enjoyed it, and they were being very careful, and they said, oh, I... You know, it kind of hit me because my show's about emotional abuse. And they said, oh, I've had some experiences and it kind of rings true. And I would have just loved to know what it was about before I went in.
Mm.
Like, that was it. They were not scarred for life. And they were they were just shaken up a bit in a way they didn't have to be.
Yeah.
It's all very calm. And, you know, none of this is like a big thing.
Not at all. And even, I mean, from that point of view is, again, it can become an active choice then. It can be an active choice to go, I want to go and confront this. Now I know what's coming. Yeah. I can choose to.
Yeah.
I can choose to or choose not to.
And to be honest, it works from what I feel. I was a bit nervous because now I've just got pamphlets that I'm handing out. So I need to find out how to get everyone to know about the trigger warning. Put it on Twitter and Facebook. And I was like, oh, there's still... I'm going to have to announce it over the speakers before I go on stage, and that might ruin it a bit. So I was a bit nervous. But actually, I think it works with the show because people are prepared. So they're ready to consider the possibility that they might actually laugh at this.
Yeah.
So that it works to my advantage even.
Yeah, I love it. Well, I'll wrap things up there. Where can people find or keep up to date with all you're doing and get your tour dates and everything else?
My website, sophiehagen.com, and that's with an F, S-O-F-I-E-H-A-G-E-N. I'm going on tour of the UK, of Denmark, doing Edinburgh. It's all this new show. Where is the trigger warning?
Yep.
And the new show is called Dead Baby Frog. And then I'm on Twitter at Sophie Hagen, Instagram at Sophie Hagen DK for Denmark, and Facebook Sophie Hagen.
Yes,
Sophie Hagen.
And I'm on your podcast. Oh, as
my podcast is called Made of Human Podcast.
Yes, and you've had some great guests on there with Josie Long and Catherine Ryan.
Oh, Joe Brand.
Yeah,
Big Deal. I had Doug Brown as well.
Yeah,
you also had
some fantastic people. So, well, thank you very much. It's been great chatting for everyone who's listening to just this, an hour or so, but we've been going for two and a half hours now. So thank you very much for the time.
Thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to Scrooby's Picks Discretion Pieces.
There we go. What a wonderful conversation, a wonderful human. If you enjoy, I really enjoyed doing Sophie's podcast beforehand. So if you did enjoy this and you're looking for more audio, then go and check that out, I reckon. Made of Human. It's available on iTunes and Acast and everywhere else, I believe. So yeah, thank you for tuning in, guys. I'll be back next week. Oh, what episode have I got next week? I think next week I've got the Ben and Jerry's special. Yeah, you heard that right. So, long story short, I got invited a little while ago to Ben and Jerry's headquarters in the UK. It's a barn. And I went there and ate ice cream and chatted to them, and they showed me around, and it was awesome. And I said this would be a cool podcast to talk to some of you guys about ice cream and about some of their campaigns, because they do a lot of charity type stuff. And they were like, yeah, well, we're up for that. So we agreed to do it. I should tell you now, it's going to sound like an advert, even though it's not an advert. I promise you, no one has paid me to do this episode. But if you follow me on social media or know me in real life, you'll know me and DJ Yoda, in fact, are obsessed with Ben and Jerry's. If a new flavour comes out, we'll be messaging each other all excited. So this is genuinely, I just got the opportunity to do this. I was like, this will be awesome. So yeah, that's coming out. It's coming out next week. I'm so ready for people to be like, I can't believe you did one that's just an advert. I've not recorded it yet, so I don't know if it will come across as an advert, but I know I get really excited when talking about ice cream. It's pizza and ice cream for me. I could talk about either of them for ages with great excitement, to the extent that people think it's an advert and it's not an advert. But yeah, that's what's going to happen. So I'm looking forward to that. So yeah, check that out next week. After that, I've already recorded an excellent episode with Ashlyn B. So yeah, really good guests flowing. I'm taking my podcasting gear up to Edinburgh with me, so I'm going to try and record a few podcasts up there. So yeah, hopefully there'll be even more exciting things in the pipeline. Thank you for tuning in, guys. This has been the Distraction Pieces podcast, episode 164. Was that right? I've said that about 10 times. Yeah, 164. I'll see you all next week. Ta-ta.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.